This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Raisi says sanctions, terrorism, and war are the major issues plaguing the world, all of which stem from unilateralism. The United States says it will blacklist three Iranian cargo planes for violating sanctions imposed on Russia. And an opinion poll shows incumbent Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro is lagging behind his main rival Lula da Silva. Hello and welcome. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisoum Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Iran's president says sanctions, terrorism, and war are the major issues plaguing the world today. Ebrahim Raisi says they are all the result of unilateralism and must be addressed through collective wisdom. Raisi made the remarks upon arrival in New York City, where he will be making his debut at the UN General Assembly. The Iranian president says sanctions have become a weapon of choice in the hands of major powers to pressure other countries. Raisi said the countries targeted will naturally head back, and so peace and security are threatened and nations harmed. The Iranian president noted that the United Nations should live up to its name and not be monopolized by powerful countries. He stressed that issues affecting the world should be settled through global participation. Meanwhile, Iran's president says that hegemonic culture is hindering the progress of countries around the world by creating an unfair global system and imposing its own cultural mindset on others. Ebrahim Raisi says countries that are maintaining such hegemony have an interest in obstructing the development of other nations. Raisi says they are exploiting international bodies in line with their own interests. He was addressing a UNESCO summit on education. The president added that Iran is critical of unilateral interpretations of contemporary history and guidelines for progress promoted by international bodies. He called for multilateral approaches. Earlier, we talked to journalist and political analyst Alicia Manier about the importance of Raisi's visit to New York and attending the UN General Assembly.
Importance of this visit is it comes just a few days after the Shanghai Cooperation Organization meeting, where the representative of half of the world were in one room, and Iran had become an official part of the organization. That calls also to end the U.S. unilateralism over the world. And President Raisi is in a position today to criticize again the U.S. unilateral and illegal sanctions on the Iranian population, which is the right of Iran to live in dignity without being under the harsh sanctions imposed by the U.S. So it is an opportunity for Iran to slam the U.S. sanctions again, and also to show to the world that it's possible to survive without the U.S. hegemony, even with very harsh U.S. sanctions.
The U.S. says it will blacklist three Iranian cargo planes for allegedly violating its sanctions on Russia. The U.S. Commerce Department says it will add the Boeing 747 planes to a list of planes believed to violate U.S. export controls. The move is part of Washington's sanctions over Russia's war in Ukraine. The Commerce Department claims the planes operated by Mahan Air, Kashma Fars Air, and Iran Air are transporting goods, including electronic items, to Russia. Three Iranian airlines are already subject to a variety of restrictions by the U.S. government. Political commentator David Yahoubian says the latest U.S. sanctions on Iranian cargo planes will bring about no effect.
I see this move as really largely symbolic. The point is that this is just layering on sanctions upon maximum pressure sanctions, upon draconian, illegal, extraterritorial sanctions, and is clearly going to be ineffectual. This is basically just demonstrating American displeasure with the exports that Iran is providing to Russia, in this case claiming that they are electronic in nature. Certainly the United States is highly hypocritical in this regard. We know full well that it continues to export electronics in the form of deadly high-tech weaponry to, among others, the apartheid state of Israel, the despotic kingdom of Saudi Arabia, and Zelensky's Ukraine. I think this is just the Washington playbook to try to continue to obtain leverage against Iran by layering on as many sanctions as possible, by printing, if possible, or if need to be manufactured, as many negative articles about Iran or Iranian society as the American mainstream media can muster. And close observers can see the ebb and flow of such stories.
Iran is commemorating its National Secret Defense Week, which marks the beginning of the 1980s war between Iran and Iraq. Iran's War University has hosted a ceremony to recount the humanitarian impacts of the eight-year war. Yusuf Jalali reports.
Free pigeons for a world free of war. Iran's War University hosted the director of the United Nations Information Center in Iran, Inger Marie Veniz, along with military attachés from different embassies, to attend this ceremony dubbed the Book of Peace and Defense, which is themed with the 1980s Iran-Iraq War. The UNIC head read out a statement from United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres during the event.
It's time to observe 24 hours of non-violence and ceasefire. We renew our call for all people to do more than lay down their weapons.
This event comes on the occasion of the National Sacred Defense Week, which marks the beginning of the 1980 to 1988 Iran-Iraq War, the longest armed conflict of the 20th century, which was waged by the then Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein and heavily funded by the West. Every year on the occasion, the Islamic Republic holds nationwide ceremonies to highlight its resistance against the Iraqi forces.
At that time, the Ba'athist regime, and on top of it, Saddam Hussein, was fully supported by numerous Western countries. The war continued for 8 years, but we fought the invaders and did not give an inch of our soil to them. So today, we as veterans feel bound to transfer our expertise and tactics to the new generation to preserve our defense might.
Saddam Hussein failed to make any achievement in his war against Iran, but the humanitarian effects of the offensive are still lingering in Iran, with many war veterans continuing to reel from exposure to chemical substances used by Iraqi forces. Those chemical materials were reportedly supplied by a number of German, French, and Dutch corporations.
The Islamic Republic takes great pride in how it defended the country during the Iraqi-imposed war, calling it the sacred defense and a drive for its present self-sufficiency in the military sector. Meanwhile, Tehran holds this annual commemoration ceremony as a chance to promote peace and shed light on the dark consequences of war. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Less than 2 weeks before Brazil's presidential elections, an opinion poll shows incumbent Jair Bolsonaro is lagging behind his main rival, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. According to an IPEC survey, the far-right president is now backed by 31% of the voters. That is against 47% who support former President Lula. The study expects a runoff in which Lula would win by 54% of the ballots against 35% for Bolsonaro. The incumbent has seen his popularity drop due to his controversial management of the coronavirus pandemic and the economy. He has said that he will retire from politics if he fails to win the upcoming vote. Ukraine says its forces have further advanced to the east into areas where Russian troops recently retreated. A Ukrainian official says the military has regained complete control of another village in the eastern Luhansk region. The official says that this ends Russia's stronghold over Luhansk after the Russian military overran it in July. Kiev is now preparing an assault on the wider Donbass region. Ukraine has also retaken more than 6,000 square kilometers of land in Kharkiv. This is in the northeast. The gains are made amid a counteroffensive against Russian forces that began earlier this month. Welcome to another edition of the News Review. In this edition, the UK doubles down on its support for Ukraine, with Prime Minister Liz Truss vowing to provide at least another $2.6 billion in military aid to Kiev next year. Truss also described Ukrainian forces' recent advances as inspirational. Truss, who is in New York for the UN General Assembly meeting, also pledged to rally support for Ukraine at the event. The UK is already the second largest military donor to Ukraine after the US. London has so far supplied Kiev with a range of weapons, including long-range rockets, anti-tank missiles, and air defense systems. Britain is also training Ukrainian military in the field. To discuss that further, we're joined by our correspondent Robert Carter, live from London, also Marcus Papadopoulos, historian, political analyst, and author, also from London. Let's begin with Robert. Robert, give us an update on this latest comment by Liz Truss and the fact that Britain, despite all of its own domestic problems, is now still planning to support Ukraine in these huge numbers.
Well, it's very peculiar, isn't it? Because as far as I was aware, the UK was in a cost of living crisis, and things were looking very bleak for ordinary British people going forward, particularly ahead of the cold winter months. But somehow the UK is coming up with huge sums of money to send to a conflict zone abroad, which, again, the UK shouldn't really be involved with. Ultimately, we are essentially in some kind of proxy war against Russia. Our allies in Ukraine, the UK's allies in Ukraine, are literally fighting Russian soldiers directly on the ground there. And of course, I don't remember ever seeing the British people, the British Parliament, vote off to okay a war with Russia. So, of course, this is all quite obscene, I think. It's reached that level now, and there are more and more people waking up to that fact. But the British government are essentially blaming Russia for everything. They're playing a Russia blame game. And ultimately, they're blaming Russia for not just the situation in Ukraine, but they're also blaming Russia now for the cost of living crisis. And essentially, they're washing their hands of any responsibility, either at number 10 or indeed in Westminster, basically playing the point finger game. And again, we come out of a time when the Queen has just been laid to rest in Windsor. That whole 11-day mourning period, including the funeral, I think is costing the UK taxpayer something like £10 million. So again, the UK is on a spending spree for things that the state finds acceptable, but the ordinary British taxpayer, the ordinary British person, is expected to put up and shut up, excuse the language, for essentially dealing with the cost of living crisis, and there's not very much that they are expected to receive in support from these major money spenders in number 10. So, of course, it's a very obscene situation, and I think that going forward, more and more people may start to realize, as the conflict in Ukraine rolls on, people's living standards continue to decline here in the UK, they might start to realize, hang on a minute, maybe rather than blaming Moscow for all of our problems, we need to start holding to account our elected leaders here in Westminster at number 10.
Okay, so Marcus Papadopoulos, we just heard our correspondent Robert describing the UK government as going on a spending spree despite all the domestic economic problems that it is facing. What do you make of the situation? Is there something behind this whole what Robert describes as a spending spree, which brings some interest for the UK government? What exactly are they doing?
Well, regardless of how much money Britain and also America send to the Ukrainian government, this will not alter what will be the eventual outcome of the war, namely a Russian victory, because Russia has the manpower, the armor, the defense industry, the willpower, the finances, and the unity of its people to achieve a victory. The Ukrainian government has none of those things. And in regard to Liz Truss's recent announcement, this demonstrates and reinforces a number of things. Firstly, it demonstrates how the British ruling elite, of which the monarchy and the aristocracy are at the centre of, are utterly indifferent to the welfare of the ordinary English, Scottish, Welsh, and Northern Irish man and woman. Secondly, it demonstrates that this is not a matter of Britain supporting the Ukrainian government. Rather, it is a matter of the British state, the British establishment, the British ruling elite supporting the Ukrainian government. And thirdly, it demonstrates that Britain is not actually a democracy, because the British ruling elite rule in their interests and in their interests only, not in the interests of the ordinary man and woman in England, Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland. And great Englishmen such as John Milton, John Locke, and John Stuart Mill, whose words on freedom, democracy, and governance are some of the most authoritative in existence, argued that when a government rules without the consent of its people on fundamental decisions, then the country is not a democracy, it is a tyranny. Thus, were the British people asked for their consent for them to be involved in an economic war with Russia, which is highly detrimental to their very existence, highly detrimental to their jobs, to their homes, which could force them into poverty, which could make them homeless? No. Likewise, were the British people asked for their consent to allow mass immigration into the UK, which has eroded quite considerably British cultural and spiritual values? Again, no. Also, were the British people asked for their consent to turn London, the capital city of the UK, into a multicultural city? Again, no, they were not. Therefore, citing the works of Milton, Locke, and Stuart Mill, I can only conclude that Britain is not a democracy. Britain is a tyranny. Tyrannies come in many guises. Tyrannies can be where there is a secret police that round up people who hold a different opinion to the government and send them to camps.
Thank you very much, Marcus Papadopoulos, historian, political analyst, and author. Also our correspondent, Robert Carter, both from London. That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. As a reminder, you heard that 10 days after Imam Khomeini is going to Kuwait from Iraq and then leaving Kuwait immediately for France, his wife and family made preparations to join him in Paris. Before going to Paris, they held the martyrdom anniversary of the Imam's elder son, Haj Aqa Mustafa, and 4 days later left for Paris. Stay tuned for the rest of the story. The arrival of Imam Khomeini's wife, Lady Khadija Saqafi, in Paris was amazing and interesting to those who met her, as she was acquainted with French language. Haj Ahmad and some of the friends had come to the airport to welcome her. There was a student among them by the name of Nasreen Hakami, who was studying postgraduate in sociology. When the car carrying Miss Saqafi entered the streets of Paris, she started reading the signs. Some of her co-travelers were surprised, and Miss Hakami asked her if she knew French. The Imam's wife answered that she had learned it before high school and continued, ironically, "Yet you shouldn't expect me to help you with your lessons." In those days, many religious families were opposed to women's education outside homes. The polite and solemn behavior of Miss Saqafi attracted the neighbors and people in Neuf-le-Château village in the outskirts of Paris. She used to stand up for guests and foresee them up the exit door. When the visitors saw her respectful, sincere, and plain conduct, they would be astonished and ask if she was the wife of the man who had staged a revolution in the world. Lady Khadija Saqafi, besides warm welcome and hospitality towards guests, used to answer their questions quiet, calmly, and patiently. This would make people interested in her, and they would become curious to know more about Imam Khomeini and his movement. One of the women who had met Imam Khomeini's wife describes her as follows. She looked very stylish in the chocolate coat and skirt, which was set with her cream shirt. She had a flowery chador on her shoulders with a headscarf which was fit with her coat and shirt. She was sitting on the ground, and we asked her to sit on the chair. She said, "It would be very bad if you sit on the ground while I'm sitting on the chair." At last, our insistence made her to sit on the chair, but the shame on her face showed her humbleness and plainness very well. Some of the visitors would ask political questions from the Imam's wife. This would make it a little difficult, as she had to answer the questions on the one hand, while avoiding answers which would cause the despotic regime in Iran to misuse the answers. Thus, she would answer some of the questions subtly and smartly. Sometimes she would say with a smile, "I am a political scholar's wife and not he himself." Some of the questions were about possible differences in her life with the Imam. She would answer like this: "Both the Imam and I reach an agreement in many differences, as we recognize differences of opinion, and very rarely do we dispute." Once she was asked if she was worried as her security was threatened. She answered, "Firstly, security is related with feeling. A part of it is real, while another part is the feeling that cowardly people would feel even if with 100 guards. Thank God the Imam is so brave that there is no fear in our house in the light of his bravery. Moreover, naturally, I am not a coward." Imam Khomeini's wife enjoyed lofty characteristics like her husband, and she didn't have any personal grudge against the Shah and his family. Thus, when the Shah was escaping from the country, she was impressed. Late Ms. Marzieh Hadidchi Dabbagh, who was in Paris in the last month of the Imam's stay, narrated an interesting account on this. "The day when the Shah went, the sounds of people's joy and the slogans of death to the Shah were heard. The people in Neuf-le-Château, too, were happy. But when I said good night to the lady, Miss Safi, she was calm and quiet. And the next morning when she got up, there was no sign of joy in her face. I told her something to make her laugh. I said, 'Lady, I congratulate you as the Shah has gone.' She said, 'We should congratulate you as you have been tortured in the prisons of Savak. But I wish this did not happen. I wish he had listened to the Imam's words in 1962 and had come to the nation so that he would not lose his popular support while going under the yoke of superpowers. I do not express happiness for the evil fate of anyone. I wish he had not become a Shah in the beginning and would not hear the chance of death to Shah these days. When I think of what a hard night he and his wife Farah are going to pass, I don't know what to say. I hope they will not commit any evil deed from now on so that their load of sins becomes heavier."
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The passing away of Queen Elizabeth II may be a sad day for a lot of people. At the same time, there are many who do not think about the Queen in positive terms. The massacre, for example, in Northern Ireland, or the chemical attack by British forces in Iraq, the role it played in a coup against Iran's Mossadegh government are just some of the things that have happened during her watch over in the UK. Now, in this edition of The Spotlight, we're going to review some of the atrocities. We will look at the expensive funeral that has been held and look at whether that is something that comes at the wrong time for the people there in the UK, and ask, was her role really ceremonial? And at the same time, we will look at whether it's time to abolish the monarchy, as many are calling. First, let's talk to Syed Purviza in London, a correspondent who joins us to tell us about the ongoings of today. Well, Syed, you were out on the streets. I spoke to you earlier. Tell us what you saw and, of course, how this thing went down against for the ones who actually thought that this was still in excess in terms of the way that it occurred, whether it's the coverage or just the whole rituals that occurred throughout the past 10, 11 days.
This cover was the final act in a 10-day performance marking the death of the longest reigning monarch in the UK that glued millions of people to their television sets and many more onto the streets to pay tribute to the Queen. And we saw a lot of people also get emotional and shed a tear, but they had their own reasons. At the same time, there were millions of others who didn't do any of that for all kinds of other reasons. One, you alluded to, the excess of it all, the fact that the taxpayer has to pick up the tab, foot the bill, so to speak, for the expense that is involved, that the British taxpayer money has to grant the monarchy that's worth tens of billions of dollars themselves, tens of millions of dollars in taxpayer money every year to cover their expenses, such as their travels and their security, as well as the renovations of their palaces. That really has not gone down well with the public here, and the public at a time when they are of having to decide between heating their homes and eating in the coming months with the soaring cost of energy that is central to driving up the cost of living, creating a crisis that has affected millions of households in across the UK, from where I am in England all the way to Northern Ireland, to Scotland, to Wales. That has not gone down well with the public, who are questioning the relevance of the monarchy as an anachronistic, outdated institution that is still around in the United Kingdom. People who are saying that they don't understand the relevance of it in the 21st century, that it's now is the time. These are Republican voices and other people who are saying that perhaps it is the time to rid the UK of the monarchy once and for all. Whether or not that will happen, or how long it'll take for that to happen, is only something that time will show moving forward. Kabe.
Thank you very much for that, Syed Pourreza. We appreciate it. Of course, one of their Syed Pourreza from London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Let me now introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Clive Menzies, researcher and political economy analyst, joins us from London. Also joining us is Sayed Mohammad Inayatullah and Drabe, who's an author and political analyst, also joining us from London. Well, I'd like to welcome you both. Clive Menzies, let me first start with you. We're looking at 11 consecutive days at this point, and so you're in London, so you could confirm this, and I'm wondering what you think about the passing away of the Queen. When we take a look at things like handwritten note from King Charles to his late mother, that's given extensive coverage, that was laid on top of her coffin. The Queen's corgis and pony await her arrival at Windsor Castle, extensive coverage. A spider appears on top of a note card, or the Queen's coffin lowered into a vault ahead of burial. Do you think that this type of coverage to this extent is actually something that's necessary?
I also question how much of it is theater, because there are reasons to suppose that the Queen may have died a long time ago, and that this was the chosen moment to effect the transition from one monarch to the other. But it presupposes that the monarch actually plays a symbolic role rather than a more powerful role. And I think it is certainly from the analysis that I've been involved with others over the years, wealth and power are synonymous. And the fact that from a cosmetic point of view, the Queen supposedly only has a symbolic role, I think the evidence suggests that the monarchy and its family have been much more involved in what has been going on for centuries, not just the current family, but also if you go, the role that they played in the 20th century has been quite pivotal in the way the world has developed. And that's what the evidence shows. In terms of the theatre that we've been subjected to over the last 10 years, I think there are those who understand what is going on, and I would say that numerically they're in the minority. There are those who resent what's going on because of the artificially created energy shortages from the so-called climate crisis, of which the current appointee to the monarchy has been instrumental in perpetuating in various guises. And then there are a majority who I would suggest are subjected to Stockholm syndrome. They're basically enthralled to their abusers because the monarchy is as much a part of the panoply of power under which we live. Uh-huh. As the government, and in fact, arguably, the government is not in control, neither is the monarchy, but both are actually answerable to a higher power that is global.
Well, that's an interesting thing you just said there. We need to open that up a little bit with you, but Said Andrabi, our guest there, also within that statement is saying that the role of the Queen or the monarchy in general is not ceremonial. Do you agree?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Does the guest say that it is not ceremonial, or is it ceremonial?
Not ceremonial.
Yes, absolutely right. I agree. It's apparently it looks symbolic and ceremonial, but it is not. It is an integral element of the British political power, British influence, global influence. It's an integral part of that. And the Foreign Office has been using royals as sort of ambassadors to different countries, creating goodwill and all these things. But apart from that, after World War II, when the empire has shrunk and there's not a huge British empire, Britain has somehow managed to maintain a power profile with the close relations with United States and other things. So this is part of maintaining a British sort of bigness in the world, having a monarchy, king, queen. This ultimately adds to the profile of Britain in the world.
Okay. Let's, Clive Menzies, talk about the last sentence that you used there, that the government and the monarchy have to answer to the perhaps whatever or whomever that's higher up. Can you please expand on that for us?
Well, there is no doubt in the world today that money rules everything. Even those in opposition are controlled by money, because everybody needs money in order to live. If you want to resist and buy weapons, then obviously money is involved. And the supranational institutions are all controlled by money. So you've got the Bank of International Settlements in Basel, which is the central banker's bank. You have the IMF, you have the World Bank, and numerous other supranational bodies, including the UN and the EU. And these are all effectively controlled by money. And if you want to test that theory, then think of the countries that have attempted to resist that monopoly of power through the control of money. Libya springs to mind, because that's what Colonel Muammar Gaddafi was trying to do. He was trying to create an alternative African Union currency in order to map a road that was independent from the mainstream. But there are numerous others who have gone against the wishes of those that control money, and they have suffered accordingly. And just in this century alone, you know, there have been numerous regime change wars that I would argue, and the evidence would suggest, have all been fomented by money power. And if you go back into the 20th century, the destruction of Germany twice, the Russian Revolution, and the Chinese Cultural Revolution were all fomented by money power. And obviously, in this format, it is not possible to go into the detail of the evidence. But for example, Yale University had a representation in China, and Mao Zedong was an attendee. And as we know, Skull and Bones, which includes George Bush Senior and Junior, both presidents, John Kerry, a putative president, were highly active, along with the Rockefellers, in China around the time of the Cultural Revolution of independence. Dr. Andrabi referred to colonialism and the independence that has been gained. But if you look at most of the countries who've won independence, in inverted commas, they may have won political independence or the cosmetic illusion of political independence, but they have not gained economic independence. And South Africa, for example, whose resources have been plundered repeatedly over the centuries, continues to have or lack economic independence because money rules effectively.
Sure. Okay, well, we're looking now that the Queen has passed away, Said Andrabi. And you have Prince Charles that is residing, and obviously all eyes are going to be on him in terms of the way that he's going to interact with the government or not interact with the government, whether he's going to interject and or not, which all signs or all reports indicate that he will not. But the perception on the monarchy itself and the descendants, in this case Prince Charles, maybe can be reflected about on the Caribbean tour that happened years ago, the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge, Kate and William, when they went to Jamaica and they faced calls for slavery reparations. They were not really welcomed there, and the Jamaican Prime Minister said that his country was moving on. Do you think that that perception, based on the history that has happened and that the UK has had, is the way that Charles is going to be received?
Well, there have been about Prince Charles and now the King Charles III. There has been a perception that he is sort of he may not be exactly as the other monarchs are. And at one time there was a perception here in Britain in the Muslim population that he is a good, friendly guy to Islam and Muslims. So those are all perceptions, but Prince Charles, the King Charles III, in his interview just 2-3 months back, recently, in an interview he said that there can be only one king on the throne, that is, by which he meant that he will be a man of his own and he will be doing things as he wishes. I think that Prince Charles will not be any weaker or softer than his predecessors. There is a continuity here. It is basically the West and the British imperial power, hegemony over the rest of the world, of which British Empire was the leading edge, that still continues, and that Prince Charles is aware of that. It's basically to ensure a complete hegemony of the world And as your guest was saying about political independence and not economic independence, the political independence of erstwhile colonies, India, Pakistan, and others being ceremonial, cosmetic, I completely agree with that. But I would add that it was independence means a comprehensive independence, political, economic, ideological, everything, which they have yet to get. They haven't got that independence. It's only a restructuring of the colonial and imperial, a new sort of world order, and nothing more than that.
Uh-huh.
So Prince Charles, the king now, I think will continue the legacy of ensuring a global hegemony through the institutions and through the system that have been built over hundreds of years.
Claude Menzies, so many questions that I had, I can't really ask you anymore because of what you have presented. So I have to go along your belief or your obviously conviction in what you have said, out of respect to you, obviously. And I'm interpreting what you have said to be the centers of money that are dictating what's going on overall, like central banks or their heads or whatever else that spells the centers of money, whether we're talking about the Rockefellers, for example, or what have you. Now, my question here is, do you think that those circles or those centers of influence are going to support what so many have called, which have increased incredibly after the passing away of the Queen, about abolishing the monarchy? Do you think that that's in the cards because it doesn't suit whatever purposes they see, or they don't see that as a future for the UK? Do you think that that is the case?
I'm not sure, and it's not something that I think is particularly important, because I think what becomes clear, if you look at the trajectory since the global financial crisis of 2008, we've been on a trajectory towards economic collapse ever since, because effectively the Fed and other central banks kicked the can down the road in terms of dealing with the problem of over-indebtedness and this sort of Ponzi economy built on just massive amounts of money. And what we've seen over the intervening years, now it's 14 years since 2008, there's been a massive increase in global capital, both by money printing by the Fed, the European Central Bank, the Bank of England. And it looks increasingly, I mean, the current rise in inflation was well anticipated by observers and analysts who were not enthralled to the current status quo. In other words, they could afford to speak out, whereas many of those in finance cannot, because it would be like turkeys voting for Christmas. So we're about to head into a period of great instability. I think that the prospect of civil unrest across Europe specifically is, and possibly America and elsewhere, is significant, but against which there is a rising tide of, if you like, grassroots organization to fill in the gaps or to compensate for what is coming in terms of food shortages, energy shortages, lack of healthcare, which is particularly relevant in the UK. And these organic self-organizing structures are what are beginning to take hold. So whilst most analysts think in terms of geopolitics and should we have a republic or should we have a monarchy, I would say a plague on all their houses. I would say that its centralized power has had its day, and it's proven to be ineffectual in managing the world for the greater good, or most beyond a relatively small number of individuals. Most are disadvantaged by the current structure. And so what I see is less about talk about republic versus monarchy, but more about the crumbling of the current structure and its institutions, which have been self-serving and have not served the interests of the majority. The cosmetics that one sees through the mainstream media would have one believe that they're working for world peace, sustainable development, and all these buzzwords. But the reality is quite the opposite. And people, a growing number of people, are waking up very quickly, which I've observed in England and elsewhere in the current year. And those institutions are being, albeit very slowly at the moment, but that will gather momentum as the chaos increases, by something much more organic and self-organizing.
Well, it's interesting when you take a look, Said Andrabi, at some of the social media reactions. You had one in particular that stood out that I'm going to ask you along the lines of what our guest there from London said about social unrest. And this person says, you're canceling people's appointments with the NHS. There are people who are dying from cancer, but they can't get their appointments going with the doctors because the Queen and the ceremony have to take place. And at the same time, people who are questioning why all this money was spent for the funeral, which just security-wise, we're looking at about $7 or $8 million, that is, of which the total cost might be maybe 40 to 50% more. And then putting into question, obviously, the whole monarchy rule. What do you think, and what camp are you in? Do you think that there should be an end to the monarchy, given the fact that you have the money factor that is associated with them, along with the either governance directly or indirectly, that people say is not warranted?
Well, let's acknowledge. I have seen people have come out in large numbers to pay their respects to the Queen. And it was general people. And people had to stand in the queue for 13 hours, for 20 hours to come to Westminster and pay their homage. These are facts which we cannot ignore. And they are significant facts. I would make a point here, and that is, it's not the question of monarchy or republicanism. It's not that UK will be a monarchy or a republic. The underlying question, the basic question is, modernity has failed. Modernity as a concept in all its practical manifestations.
Sure. I'm so sorry, I got to jump in because we're fresh out of time on this. I do apologize. Our time has run out, but thank you very much, and sorry to have ended your statement. Said Mohammad Aniyatullah Andrabi, author and political analyst, thank you. Clive Menzies, a pleasure, thank you. Researcher and political economy analyst from London. We had Said Pourza at the top of the hour, correspondent from London. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Ikava Takwai, it's goodbye until next time.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Thank you. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of Arab English Radio. We're welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I'm Atta, the host of this program. I have a very special guest speaker for today's discussion, Dr. Hojatul Islam Karimi from the Islamic Seminary of Qom. Dr. Karimi, assalamu alaikum. Welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Okay, does religion and religious belief bring supremacy to someone? This is the main topic for today's discussion. Let's just start by giving an example, Sheikh Karimi, and then get to the main discussion. For example, we have so many people who are not Muslim. They do some actions which are against Islamic beliefs, for example, like drinking alcohol or liquors, but they're good people. At the same time, we have so many people who are Muslims. They are bound by their religion. You know, they abide by their religious beliefs. And by the religion of Islam, they are considered as a Muslim, a person who is submission to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. But ethically speaking, they are not good. So compared with each other, which one has the greatest status in the eyes of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It's a very difficult job to... have a kind of judgment about the people, because of course let's talk about Muslims. We have a group of do not compare Muslims with non-Muslims. Imagine we have a group of Muslims who are practicing, but they have bad temperedness, and we have a group of Muslims who are good tempered, but for example they drink alcohol. Which yes. one is worse than the other? So here we do not have the difference in terms of faith, because both of them are Muslims. So here, even in this case, we cannot have, true judgment among the two, and we need to leave the judgment to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And I will have some explanations, because there are many details. So, for example, the one who drinks alcohol, how many times? The one who is bad-tempered, there are many levels in this regard. So there are so many examples, so many levels, and we cannot have a kind of final judgment about the people. We need to leave the judgment to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. But to give a short answer to this question, the tone of the verses and narrations about drinking alcohol is somehow more harsh and more threatening. Having said that, let me refer to one point, and that is the fact that we know that we have a division for the sins. Both bad-temperedness and drinking alcohol are sins. We have major sins and we have minor sins. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in chapter Nisa verse 31 says that if you avoid major sins, kabair ma tunhauna an, if you avoid the major sins that you are forbidden, nukaffir ankum sayyi'atikum, we will absolve you of your misdeeds and admit you to a noble abode. This verse is referring to the fact that we have two categories of the sins, the major ones and the minor ones. And the same had been mentioned in chapter Shura, verse 37. We have a number of narrations about this fact, the fact that we have two groups, two categories of